I love that we can still make sense.
This is Pure Decking for Thursday, December the 5th, 2013. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like descending into a police state, information security, and whatever drugs RU is currently prescribing for me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Madman, RU, and the Suave. I am currently drinking a Blue Moon Mountain Abbey Ale. What you guys got?
I'm drinking Maker's Mark again, because
that's
amazing.
Doing better than I am. Are you? What are you lacing your coffee with?
I've got a six-pack of, what was that stupid beer you guys like to drink again? Dock Top, that's right. And I'm pouring it down the toilet, because it's just that shit.
Oh, I didn't show Madman. Yes, Madman, you got feedback.
Parts of me want to stab you right now. I've got feedback.
You've got feedback. That's the best part.
They're blaming you for what I've been saying. It's great.
There you go, Madman. I'll send it to you in TeamSpeak private channel there. There you go. But, somebody called Shock Top Lover sent you some fantastic feedback there. And I guess they got confused between Madman and RU. Because they were mad at you.
No, I actually disparaged Shock Top's pumpkin spice beer last one of our shows.
Oh, that was on Let's Get Drunk.
Yeah. Sweet. I've got flaming kittens coming to murder me in my sleep.
I mean, of all the people to threaten with flaming kittens, really? You think it's going to work on Madman?
Madman's liable to light his own cats on fire anyways. I mean,
he was filming him for YouTube in a penned fight this morning.
So, what are you drinking, Madman?
I'm currently drinking a Samuel Adams Juniper IPA, and if Shock Top Lover's listening, it is so much better than the pumpkin wheat that's still in my fridge, because I couldn't drink the last two bottles yet. I can't bring myself to throw it away, because it's beer, and by God, I'm going to drink it. But it's going to be the last two beers I drink.
Ever.
So, we're back from Thanksgiving, and it looks like I was the only one who took any holiday time, because Lauren, everybody else did their shows. So, yeah, I'm putting a big post up on the website, like, we're not doing shows, go away. It's like, everybody else did shows. So, I'm going to have to do something about a schedule on the front page, find some way to keep up with that a little bit better.
Yeah, but you go putting the schedule out there, I'm changing my day.
Yeah, you will. We're doing IHN Sunday evenings now, just to screw with you.
At 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m., there you go. So, anyways, let's go ahead and move on to our discussion topic here. I've been kind of playing with it all morning, and there's so much news about it, you can't get away from it. It's pretty much Bitcoin mania right now.
Kill me.
I mean we're in full tilt beanie baby mode at this point, I think.
Kill me. If I hear another thing about Bitcoin, I'm going to kill someone.
Well, I hope your wife isn't nearby.
No, she was talking about it last night.
Oh, damn.
Last night.
Well, Business Insider had two stories which were all over the fucking place. A guy in California bought a Tesla Model S using Bitcoins. Now, I think that's the dealer. That's not the Tesla company. That's the dealer, the Newport Lamborghini dealer in California there. I mean, that's total media stunt. That's...
Oh, yeah.
But, and apparently Bank of America is going to start tracking Bitcoin as well.
If they start using Bitcoin, that will go a long way to fixing Bitcoin's big problem.
Well, China just banned banks from using it. At least that's what Suave told me earlier.
Actually, I was doing some more reading, and basically what they said They don't want like money changers, banks, or any other sort of like institution like that that handles national currencies, because they're basically saying, no, we don't want it. This isn't a currency. But at the same time, they also said it's perfectly okay for you to use it and transact for goods with it as long as you assume the risk. So they're basically saying, yeah, we don't want our banks dealing with it, but if you want to use it, we're not going to stop you. So it's kind of a mixed message. And I think a lot of people saw that this morning and panic sold. I think it dropped down to like 870 this morning at like 5 a.m. when that news came out. But it immediately like bounced back up to like 1100. So it's kind of bad, but at the same time, it's kind of good because they're semi endorsing it, or at least saying that it's okay to use it.
Well, but the thing is, I'm still trying to figure out. I'm playing with it more. I mean, I've when we get into Dojo, I built a mining rig. It's sitting on my living room table, and I don't think it'll catch fire, but it's currently going away. I have already have a couple of Bitcoin, like 0.00007 of a Bitcoin or something like that, for about an hour's worth of runtime, which isn't bad. I'll get into that in Digital Dojo, but I'm not putting anything else into it. I'm just gonna like mine up a little bit to play around, because I still feel like. I'm still trying to figure out. I feel like something else is going on here. This isn't just a currency. There's something. The concept of the internet Linden dollar, pretty much, you know, where you have money you can spend online. It's a fine concept. I mean, and I'm cool with, you know, having a couple of accounts floating around, but this thing has gone from $2 a coin to $1,000 a coin in a year.
That's big problem with Bitcoin, is it's not a currency.
Yeah.
It's an investment. People are buying it and holding on to it. You're not doing normal transactions with Bitcoins right now. And that's one reason it's so easy to inflate the price and why it's going through a speculative bubble. It's not people buying Bitcoin because they love the idea of Bitcoin and are using Bitcoin to buy sandwiches and shirts and just stuff. It's people buying Bitcoin, holding on to Bitcoin, hoping the price will go up, and eventually selling their Bitcoins at a profit. And so long as that's the primary use of Bitcoin, Bitcoin's not going to be what its creators intended it to be, which is an everyday currency that is stable and not held up with the whims of governments and inflation.
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes no sense to spend Bitcoin on anything right now, because tomorrow it might be worth $100 more than what it's worth now.
Dude, I just look at Bitcoin like a hipster's turntables. They just sit in the corner, something to look at. Hey, look what I've got. Are you ever going to use it? Fuck no. Move on.
That's probably a pretty good comparison, actually.
And until people can use it in day-to-day transactions and start using it in those transactions, that's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, they'll always make a bit of vinyl every now and then, but no one's ever going to go back to using vinyl.
I think you're right, absolutely right, for like day-to-day transactions, because really the only way it's feasible right now is if you've got a smartphone, and you know, not everybody's got a smartphone, so it's convenient for some, but it's not really accessible to
everyone. It makes great sense, concept-wise, for, you know, buying shit on Amazon. Or
yeah.
paying
oh,
for
absolutely.
A website host. But, you know, you're not buying your lunch with it, at least not in very many places.
In first world countries, many people have smartphones, and they're already coming out with a credit card. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's just a Bluetooth magnetic strip you sync up to your phone. That can so be used with Bitcoin. So the getting it into stores isn't an issue. It's just that stores aren't using it.
Right.
And until commerce, it can be, until you can use it for commerce, it is just going to be a bunch of people buying it, holding it, and creating this huge speculative bubble. Because Bitcoins aren't worth $1,100. It's going to pop. I don't know where it's going to end up, but I know for a fact they're not worth $1,100 a piece.
Well, do you think they'll go all the way back down to the $2 we started the year at?
With the way we've been treating the dollar, no, it's probably going to end up in at least the $20 or $30 range. But it's going to drop massive from the $1,100 that it's at now.
But, you know, that is a little bit of a logical fallacy, because you can't say it's not worth $1,100 a piece, because it is worth $1,100 a piece. People are paying $1,100 for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like with any currency like this, like even the U.S. dollar, it only has value because people give it value. Like it doesn't do anything. You can't trade it in for a lump of gold. You know, it's just some numbers that represent value. And, you know, you could say that for any currency. It's whatever people are willing to exchange it for, that's what its value is.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so I guess from my point of view, like, early on, none of the places where you could get bitcoins, every time I look around to getting one, it's like, man, that looks shady. The only safe way it looked like there was to get Bitcoin was to like go get a Visa gift card or some, you know, one-time credit card deal to, I mean, now it's a little bit better, but I mean, at the time everything looked so damn sketchy. But, so the only way I'm really going to be putting anything into Bitcoin at the moment is mining, because I've got a little mining rig I'm playing around with, but that's mostly because I want to play with the technology. Do you guys think mining is still viable? I've actually had a hell of a time trying to find good information on this either way. Apparently, everybody who's hardcore into mining tells everybody else not to get into it because they don't want the competition.
Well, also, because at this point, it's not really cost-effective for your average person to do it. Like, the only people where it's really cost-effective to do it are the ones who have, like, you know, specialized setups at this point, just because it has become so competitive because so many people are doing it. And you know, like, it's probably going to be at that point where it's going to be razor thin margins, forever at this point now.
Yeah.
So it's probably going to be some, you know, just the big players who are really going to make money mining Bitcoin.
Has anyone reworked the numbers since it shot up?
Actually, I've got a calculator. This bitcoinx.com/profit has an interesting JavaScript-based calculator that you can plug various bits into. Okay, it pulls down bitcoins per block, the difficulty, the conversion rate, and you tell it, you know, what, how many gigahashes you're pulling. So I'm just gonna put it in right now. Power consumption about 3, because mine's a Raspberry based thing. Cost of mining hardware we'll put $150 in. That's a little bit much, but and calculate it. So according to this, for the cost of a Raspberry and my ASIC miners, it's going to take me nearly 2 years to recoup at the current mining rate. Oh, I did that wrong. I only did that for the hash rate for 2.
It's like 200 years.
No, 2 years. But that's only using 2 of the ASIC miners. If I use all 4... I'll recoup my costs in 243 days at the current rate. So
if it stays up there within a year, you're making decent profit.
That's a fallacy though, because it gets harder every time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's just like, eh. It's interesting. I'm playing with it, but I'm not. I'm certainly not planning my retirement around it.
Yeah.
I also don't expect bitcoins to still be holding this crazy value they're holding a few years from now. I don't know how long the time's going to take, but I think Madman's right. I don't think the average value of a bitcoin should be what it is.
You got to remember, too, like, everybody always looks at it because, you know, you're used to looking at, like, okay, well, a dollar is worth this. So you look at this, like, a single bitcoin is worth this huge amount of money. But you got to remember, there aren't a lot of bitcoins available to begin with.
I saw an interesting workup somebody did on Reddit, where they were thinking something along the lines of 30 to 40% of the bitcoins that have been mined have been lost, because apparently there's a crap ton of wallets out there sitting with bitcoin in them, like 50 bitcoins in them from like the early mining days. That just have been abandoned or forgotten about.
And, you know, some of those will be recovered. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are just sitting on them waiting for the price to go up and stuff like that. But, you know, they're probably right. It is probably about 30%. And, you know, at least, because that's just those ones. Like, there could be more. And then you've got the people who... But it doesn't really matter, because even if there's down to, like, one Bitcoin, it would still be perfectly viable as long as people could get past this mental block of dealing with, like, fractions of something. But it's, you can divide it down as many times as you want. Like, currently, I think the program's set up for, like, I think it's, like, 8 decimal places. I could be wrong on this. Don't quote me on it. But if they ever wanted to change it, that wouldn't be difficult to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you were talking about how, what was it you were watching? Was it Mt. Gox? You were watching the trades and you started flipping out because they had switched to Microcoin or MicroBitcoin?
I was on Bitcoinity.
Bitcoinity, okay.
Yeah, they just, they show prices for a bunch of different exchanges. And they switched to the MicroBitcoin. Now it's $1.04 per MicroBitcoin, pretty much.
Well, that you know, if you could get everybody to work in that, that would be a little easier to wrap your head around the numbers.
There's a really big push for it right now in the Bitcoin community for everybody to switch over.
Well, if they could do that and keep the micro Bitcoin floating around a dollar, that would also help to maintain that big price of a Bitcoin.
Yeah. So. But, you know, one last thing I wanted to say. You know, like, as more and more people are getting into it and stuff like that, I feel like we are starting to see the effects of that stabilization where you have, like, that many more people in there, so a lot more money has to move to really destabilize things. Whereas, like, you know, this morning when, like, there was this big crash because everybody was panic selling, it recovered and came back to, you know, around where it was before within 2 hours. Like, it wasn't, like, this big thing where it, like, you know, lost 30% and just stayed that way for a couple weeks or something. It was just, like, almost like a minor fluctuation at this point.
Well, let's move on to current events before RU starts, you know, murdering small animals.
No, it's just final thing on that, too. Well, if there are more and more people moving in, that just means there's going to be more and more predators on the outside.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hacking will take on a whole new term if you can get your hands on somebody's Bitcoin wallet.
It does stabilize it as a microcurrency, though. Iceland was having trouble with their currency being so overvalued. It really hit their country hard on exports, and then it started tanking their economy.
Yeah,
I mean, Bitcoin's not going to have that problem because no country is actually using it, and it's not currently a currency. But if it ever becomes a currency, you want enough people in there that those hits don't happen.
All right. Anybody else want to throw anything in on Bitcoin here? Because I'm pretty much hit everything I was wanting to talk about on it. Cool. First story up is from sacramento.cbslocal.com. A child pornography arrest helped by Google is raising privacy concerns. Federal investigators arrested a Woodland man on child pornography charges after Google found images on his computer. Google's cyber criminal investigators are faceless servers looking across the internet for child pornography. Each image that's uploaded to the web has its own unique digital fingerprint. According to a criminal complaint obtained by CBS 13, they found it in Woodland. Stunned neighbors on Carlsberg Place recently woke up to the sight of police cars and FBI raid jackets. It was pretty scary for everybody, said Lindsay Griffiths. They witnessed Raul Gonzalez, 40, being arrested. He's accused of having more than 3,000 pornographic pictures of children on his cell phone. He must have opted for the 32-gig model to... I'm sorry, but that's a lot of pictures on a phone. The FBI says that the investigation began in March when Google's hashing technology found two child porn images in his Picasa library. Picasa is a cloud sharing platform for images owned by Google. From there, the company notified the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which says it found more images in a Tumblr account owned by Gonzalez. That's where the feds took over. Agents said they also found pictures of a 9-year-old who was close to the family, and Gonzalez admitted to sexually assaulting the child. Okay, so he's a scumbag, cut off his head with something blunt. Google says that they have an account with... If you have an account with them, it's not just indiscriminately searching through your pictures, but their servers are looking for possible digital fingerprints the FBI might be interested in. They could have phrased that a little bit better.
Yeah.
The company says its database is shared with law enforcement and watchdog groups such as the Internet Watch Foundation and National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. When an image is found, an employee will inspect it to make sure it's an actual abuse and not just a picture of a child at bath time. Microsoft also developed photo DNA to match pictures using just a pixel. How do you match pictures using just one pixel? Just, okay.
That looks like a red one to me.
Well, color and position is a lot of information, but...
Yeah, well, you know, I'd feel like you'd probably be better off with, like, 3 pixels or something like that. Then you'd probably be able to narrow it down significantly. Yeah.
That allows investigators to find out if a picture previously identified as child porn gets re-uploaded to the web. So, what this means is anytime you upload a picture to a Google service, they're running it against an algorithm that's looking to see if it could be child porn. Wow. And then if it is, they have a Google employee actually look at your picture to make sure that it's, you know, could be, you know, that it's actually infringing. And if it's not just something innocent that their filter happened to pick up, which probably happens a lot more than they'd want to talk about.
That poor bastard who has to sit there and check out all these images.
Ooh, talk about a sucky job.
Yeah, I don't want that job.
Really?
I mean, I can have a dark right and now. Horrible sense of humor, but I think I would kill myself or lots of other people if I had that job.
With any luck, they probably rotate that position around.
Like, you get the crap job today. How many babies did you see in a blender?
8.
That's a new office pool if I ever get that job.
Every time someone knocks on your door,
the mood.
Go away, Biden.
Oh, God.
I'm not sure if I think this is bad. Because, at least in the U.S., no constitutional rights were violated. You have no protection from Google, only from the United States government.
You gave those up when you agreed to Google's terms and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already assuming that they're scanning everything that I do. That's why I randomly type words into their search engine just as to fuck with them.
That's the spirit.
See, now to go with that, you need a small Python script that occasionally orders items from Amazon that cost less than $5. Just, to, you know, random stuff. So that, you know, you can get on the watch list when the script orders rubber tubing right after you search for, I don't know, limb severance.
Sulfuric acid.
Yeah.
All right. Next story up, this one is from Torrent Freak. One of the most popular multi-purpose downloading tools on the web today is JDownloader, a Java-based tool compatible with Windows, Linux, and Mac. The software is able to download video files from file hosting sites, and extract them all once completed. Back in June, the software became embroiled in court proceedings over a specific feature present in an unofficial beta of JDownloader 2, which enabled the downloading of RTMPE video streams on top of existing RTMP. That's encrypted video streams. It wasn't created by AppWorks themselves, but was a contribution from an open source developer who had worked with the project before. Since the plugin handled encrypted streams, the Hamburg Regional Court decided that this represented a circumvention of effective technological measures under Section 95A of Germany's Copyright Act. As a result, the court issued a preliminary injunction against JDownloader 2 and threatened its makers, AppWorks, with a €250,000 fine for production, distribution, and possession of an illegal piece of software. AppWorks found out about the functionality of the plugin months before the court case and had already disabled it, but the judgment had the potential to have a chilling effect on open source development. Are developers really liable if another developer in the community commits code that might be protected somewhere in a software patent? How are open source communities supposed to check? What if a program that is included in another open source program makes an update that adds illegal functionality? The company told Torrent Freak at this time. To find out, AppWorks filed an appeal, and this week the project received the decision of the court. It was bad news not only for the company, but also for open source community in general. In the eyes of the judges, our company made the open source contributions our own mostly by having a copyright sign in the info dialogue. AppWorks Alex informs Stormfreak. Therefore, we are liable and must actively screen every code contribution and or have protective mechanisms in place to have someone committing something that might be illegal. Alex says the decision is worrisome for open... I don't even need to finish this. Somebody wrote a plugin for JDownloader that let it decrypt these encrypted video streams. So Germany said that's a violation of copyright law and went after the hosting program, not the guy who wrote the plugin. If Suave's, your mic's muted.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, because, like, absolutely, like, thinking about it from the business standpoint, regulatory standpoint, you really need something in place to prevent people from just going willy-nilly and, like, ripping off code and stuff like that. So, if you are running a project, like any business, if they were running a project and write a piece of software, it is their responsibility to do the research and look at all the patents and everything like that and make sure that you're not infringing on anybody. And that's like a huge... I work with a lot of R&D and stuff like that, and that's actually a huge cost involved in developing a product, because you have to go and make sure that you're not ripping anyone off. So I feel like open source projects and stuff like that, there should be a mechanism put in place to at least do some sort of cursory search for that sort of thing. Because you're not making money off of it, I feel like they shouldn't be held to quite a high degree of sticking to the letter of the law. But I definitely think that it should be their responsibility to look into that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, the part I worry about here is they're saying that this JDownloader is responsible for code that was committed by somebody else. And it wasn't even code they had shipped. It was one of, like this pre-build beta. I'm guessing it's like the Nightlies. It's built by a script. It's not, something anybody looked at. And they disabled it when they figured out they were probably in violation of the law. So, but it didn't matter because the code existed.
I'm saying that is the particular problem. They didn't infringe on anything because they took it out.
But they still got sued.
Yeah.
That's where I think this lawsuit was wrong and the judges were wrong. If they had left it in or stuck it out there, then yeah, I would see the problem they're infringing on someone's copyright. But they took it out. They did everything in good faith to uphold the copyright law. Which, if Germany's anything like the United States, there are dozens of patents on a widget.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, so, I mean, I'm
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you extrapolate this out, think about things like AdBlock Plus and Firefox. Does that mean that Mozilla is responsible for the content that AdBlock Plus stops, because AdBlock Plus is a plugin for Firefox, and damn well there's a couple of companies out there that if they could sue Mozilla for AdBlock Plus, they would.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, according, if this precedent exists in Germany, they can sue Firefox for AdBlock Plus in Germany. If AdBlock Plus violates any patents.
Question.
Was this what were they? F something downloader?
J downloader.
There we go. Was J downloader hosting the plugin on their site?
Yeah, I think it sounded like it got uploaded to their repository, their code repository, by somebody who had been committing patches to the program previously.
Right. I feel like, for an open source project, there should just be a mechanism in there being like, oh well, hey, we found this. Take it down immediately, and then if you don't, then there should be legal consequences.
Well, if they're using something sensible like SVN or Git, it was probably just in a branch. It would
right.
be nothing just to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but if I was understanding this right, they did take it out of their program, right?
They disabled it. I don't know
they
that they completely
it.
Removed it, but they said okay. They disabled it. So I don't know. That's just that worries me a little bit, because suddenly your open source contributions, granted, your code probably ought to be checked by somebody in the project anyways, but I mean, I can kind of see both sides of it.
Like, just because it's open source doesn't mean they can violate patents.
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, I don't like the idea of, I write a program and put it out there, and somebody else extends my program, and I'm liable for what they did, kind of thing.
Right.
Because that kind of feels like, at some point it's out of your hands if you've, if I were to take a script that I wrote and post it online, and somebody were to modify that script to where it did something evil, I shouldn't be responsible for what they did with it, even if they re-uploaded it back to, like, if I threw it up on GitHub or something, even mm-hmm. if they submitted it as a patch on my GitHub account, why should I still be responsible for their patch?
Right.
Especially if I don't accept their code. So, just I can kind of see both sides of it.
Yeah.
I see that the company covering themselves when they disabled it.
I almost feel like this is another one of those situations where the laws don't really apply to the situation.
And somebody just managed to win on that note anyways. Or yeah. They got a judge who, like, really didn't understand, didn't care, just wanted to be done with it.
Yep.
So.
Well, what sucks is it's setting a bad precedent. Now, even if an open source project tries to cover its ass, which I think they did when they were disabling the code, there now could still possibly just be screwed over.
Well, Germany's illegal software laws are crazy compared to just about everywhere else.
This is true.
A lot of guys who were writing security tools out of Germany had to quit doing it or move. Like, the FireSheep guy had to pretty much quit what he was doing, because their anti-hacking laws are very, very aggressive compared to pretty much everywhere else. So, let's see. Next story up is from Ars Technica and is going to make everyone absolutely happy. Newly anointed Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler said this week that it would be okay for internet service providers to charge Netflix and other companies for a faster lane to consumers. Wheeler's stance is surprising, given that it appears to contradict the FCC's open internet order passed by his predecessor in 2010. That order, which sets out the country's network neutrality rules, said that fixed broadband providers may not unreasonably discriminate against any type of traffic. The order specifically called out pay-for-play arrangements as being potential violations. Broadband providers that sought to offer pay-for-priority services would have an incentive to limit the quality of service provided to non-prioritized traffic. The rules state, for a number of reasons, a commercial arrangement between a broadband provider and a third party to directly or indirectly favor some traffic over other traffic in the broadband internet access service connection to a subscriber of the broadband provider, i.e. pay-for-priority, would raise significant cause for concern. As a general matter, it is unlikely that pay-for-priority would satisfy the no unreasonable discrimination standard. The open internet order is being challenged in court by Verizon. A Verizon win would let ISPs block content or change providers for a faster lane to customers. The rule is still in place, at least until the U.S. Court of Appeals makes a decision. Wheeler, a former lobbyist for the cable and wireless industries, hint, hint.
Oh, my freaking crap. Can we shoot him?
I'd love to. Spoke positively about the order, but said he wouldn't mind if Netflix has to pay for a faster lane to consumers while answering questions Monday after a policy speech at Ohio State University. I'm a firm believer in the market, he said. I think we're going to see a two-sided market where Netflix might say, well, I'll pay in order to make sure that you might receive, my subscriber receives, the best possible transmission of this movie. I think that we want to let those kinds of things evolve. We want to observe what happens from that, and we want to make decisions accordingly, but I will go back to the fact that the marketplace is where these decisions ought to be made, and the functionality of a competitive marketplace dictates the degree of regulation. Wheeler's comment implies that he believes the open internet order already allows such arrangements, or he wants to change it. The remark came just seconds after Wheeler said, "We stand for an open internet." He said that he expects the court's decision on net neutrality rules to come this month or next month, and that he hopes it will affirm the FCC's position that ISPs shouldn't be allowed to block content. We're hopeful that the court will affirm the fact that reasonable means that we can require carriers to make sure they provide access, he said. So he's still not, you know, up for the censoring, but he's cool with the tiered internet that net neutrality is trying to fight.
But so, the tiered internet, it kind of exists. I have a 10 meg or
no, no, the... no. That's not the tiered internet, Madman. The tiered internet.
That's
is...
what the tiered internet should be. Don't take away my Netflix or anything else I want to look at, damn it.
The tiered internet is something more along the lines of, you want the Facebook package or the social media package. So that's $5 a month. Oh, you want the gamer package. Well, that, you know, with access to Steam, well, that's $30 a month. And then they turn around and charge, like, Netflix and YouTube access fees.
Yeah.
They basically turn the internet from an open network connection into basic cable, where you get the packages they select and you pay extra for the bonuses.
They're pretty much holding the content providers at ransom. They're like, hey, your users aren't going to be able to use your service properly. Like, let's say Steam. Okay, sure. They have to pay for priority. If they don't get priority, obviously it's going to be slower because somebody else is getting that priority. So, you know, when you, like, all of your customers all of a sudden are getting all of their stuff at, like, half the speed, that's going to cause huge issues. And, yeah, that's a really, really slippery slope. I know I fucking hate that argument, but really, that is.
Well,
it's going to hurt startup companies like
absolutely.
Mad. Because you're not going to get priority direction to your site. You might not get direction to your site.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you wouldn't be found at all. Because you wouldn't have hardly any way of driving traffic, and if you did drive traffic, it would be painfully slow because you're not in the fast lane.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd kill Galaxy 15. I'm just going to flat out say that. If they let this priority stuff go, we would not. Because it would be impossible to listen to our stream. Even though 128K a second is relatively low bandwidth these days, if it's being cut because it's not prioritized content, you wouldn't be able to listen to it, and that'd be the end of it.
Yeah.
Nope.
So we'd have to go to basically being a podcast-only network where we do the live shows and let you download them, and I guess we'd have to kill the stream in the station because it just wouldn't be usable.
Just go back to a normal front page.
Yeah. So
we kick and fight all we want, but it's going to happen.
Well,
they've
got a lobbyist.
For the world.
they've got a lobbyist in the FCC chairmanship position now. So, yeah, what was that Obama promised when he was elected about not giving lobbyists?
Don't listen to his promises. They just make you sad.
I just like pointing out hypocrisy.
The Electronic Freedom Foundation will win on this one.
It'd be like our prime minister. Just because I said it doesn't mean that's what I said. God, listen to me, people.
Oh, the carbon tax bullshit, yeah. That was hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that until I'm elected. Then I'm going to do that.
Well, see, there's a promise, and then there's a non-core promise. And that was a non-core promise. There was no actual truth in the core of the matter there. So non-core promise, promise. Learn the difference between your politicians. Hard to spot at the time, but you'll find out 6 months later when you're taxed for it.
It's called a promise and a lie.
No, non-core promise. Politicians, you can't see my air quotes. This isn't working.
I heard it in your voice, are you? I just wanted to say it's a lie.
I don't know whether it's just getting fucking worse, or I'm getting more and more cynical each day because
it's getting harder and harder not to
stick the gun in the mouth of the person you're lying next to. Because don't stick it in your mouth, that's just stupid.
But that won't solve the problem, because the odds are you're not lying with somebody important enough to shoot.
Oh, I whore out at night down in Canberra. Ooh, yeah.
Okay, well then it might work for you. Unfortunately, I'm not lying next to anyone important enough to shoot. Now, if I could fuck my way into the White House, I'd just go on a killing spree.
And Madman was never seen again.
Oh, crap. People actually listen to this show.
Yeah, we've
and
got
the
three
cops
right
come
now.
To my house.
I don't know. Right. Bullshit.
Yeah.
You're going to notice a pattern where I got my stories this week. Next one's from Torrent Freak. Earlier on December the 4th, Torrent Freak reported that Hotfile and the MPAA had settled their legal dispute with an $80 million settlement. Holy crap.
Wow.
Who said the MPAA paid out? Because that would
no,
make me happy.
No.
You're killing all the happiness in the world, Norbs. All the happiness in the world.
That's what do we used to call this show? The Depression Hour?
Very gonna be better if we just film someone hitting a kitten with a hammer. Yeah. It'd be a lot happier. At least eventually it'd be over for the kitten.
While the agreement left room for the file hosting service to continue its operations by implementing a filtering mechanism, the company has decided to throw in the towel. After a few minutes, the Hotfile site was replaced with an image that contains the following text. As a result of the United States Federal Court having found Hotfile to be in violation of copyright law, the site has permanently shut down. If you are looking for your favorite movies or TV shows online, because that's the only thing Hotfile must have ever hosted, then there are more ways than ever today to get high-quality access to them on legal platforms. Yeah, I'm sure Hotfile wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
The notice in question is strikingly similar to the one ISOHunt displayed last month following its defeat at the hands of the movie studios. The similarities suggest that both messages were drafted by the MPAA. You know that was part of the, some settlement to post this crap, probably to get that $80 million number down.
Yeah.
The decision to shut down the site without giving any notice whatsoever is causing problems amongst users and businesses who relied on Hotfile to store files and documents. Samsung firmware provider Sam Mobile, for example, has been forced to move its files to another hosting provider with a 2-day break in service. It will take at least 48 hours before we're able to finish uploading all firmware. So do forgive us if you're unable to get that firmware you wanted to download for the next couple of days, Sam Mobile notes. It's unclear how many of the millions of Hotfile users stored files without a backup, but the number could easily run into tens of thousands. Torrent Freak has reached out to Hotfile to ask when the company will offer a solution for affected users and has yet to hear back. Following the mega upload debacle of 2012, this is the second major blow for a U.S.-linked cloud hosting provider. Needless to say, the recent events have put a serious dent in users' trust and may ultimately hurt the industry overall, because they keep getting shut down. Yeah, no, don't upload anything to a file locker without having a backup.
Yep.
That almost defeats the purpose of their existence, though.
Yes, it does.
Actually, hold up. That does defeat the purpose of their existence for a lot of users.
Really, the only thing they would be useful for is like a temporary transfer.
Yeah, getting it to somebody else.
Yeah, instead of using like email or something.
So,
this is just assuming that all they were doing was illegal stuff. You should just go after the people that were actually uploading that crap
There's tons of sites, especially in the different Android communities. Hotfile was very popular for uploading firmwares. There was a post on the front of XDA today about don't discuss piracy in our forums because of what just happened to Hotfile, and if you were hosting something on Hotfile, you need to re-upload it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So this is just flat out terrorizing online service providers. I mean, yeah, somebody did something with their service that violated copyright law. But
then you go after that person. You don't go after the landlord because one of his tenants is selling drugs in his apartment building. You go after the tenant.
But you see, that's too hard, and the judges don't really understand this thing, so they keep winning these cases. And they have more money than you, so they win.
But they're fucking up the world, the whole fucking world, and they're breaking it.
Next level of hell, please.
All right, next level of hell. This one is from ArsTechnica.com. Underscoring the growing sophistication of internet crime, researchers have documented one of the first known botnets to target point-of-sale terminals used by stores and restaurants to process customers' credit cards and debit payments. The botnet remains active at the time of this writing and has compromised more than 20,000 payment cards since August, researchers told IndieCrawler, a Los Angeles-based security intelligence provider. The researchers arrived at the findings after infiltrating one of the control servers used to send commands to the infected machines and receive pilfered data from them. A recently captured screenshot shows that it was controlling 31 machines that the researchers said belonged to U.S.-based restaurants and retailers. Some of the infected machines are servers, so the number of affected point-of-sale devices could be much higher. You know, because if you get the server for the store, that's every wow. point-of-sale device in the store. Researchers have reported their findings to law enforcement agencies so they declined to identify by name. Point-of-sale hacking is nothing new. The best-known incident for stole data for more than 146,000 cards, infecting more than 200 terminals used at Subway sandwich stops and other small merchants. According to federal prosecutors, the criminals behind the intrusions infected one or more servers with sniffing software that logged payment card numbers and sent them to a remote server. Although the now convicted crooks were able to install a backdoor on the computers they accessed so they could change configuration settings and install new programs, there is no evidence of a botnet that actively controlled the infected machines in lockstep. The infections observed by IntelCrawler, by contrast, are much more advanced. They allow attackers to corral large numbers of point-of-sale devices into a single botnet. The interface makes it easy to monitor the activities of infected machines in real time and issue granular commands. In short, they are the point-of-sale terminals with Zeus, Citadel, and other banking trojans are to online bank accounts. The code helped to streamline the process has been dubbed Stardust. It's a major revision of Dexter, previously discovered piece of malware targeting point-of-sale devices that have already been fingerprinted in other real-world payment card swindles. The unique side of our case is that it's a real botnet with CNC functions, which is active close to half a year and controlled by a group of criminals, which has a new type of Dexter, IntelCrawler CEO Andriy Komarov wrote in an email. The infected point-of-sale merchants are installed in different places and cities, which makes it different as the bad actors infected them separately and then organized a botnet from it. Stardust developers have intimate knowledge of the inner workings of point-of-sale applications, such as ClearView point-of-sale. As a result, malware can ferret out from where in the computer memory sensitive data, in some cases in clear text form, is stored. Stardust can also sniff network traffic and is able to extract track 1 and track 2 card data. To remain covert, the software transferred card details only when the terminal is inactive and the screensaver is on. It also uses RC4 to encrypt the data before sending it to the control server. So now the botnets are getting into your freaking cash registers and grabbing your credit card as you swipe it directly. They're not even bothering with the skimmers. They're just going straight for the computer systems that control everything.
Looking at this article, weren't they saying that they had to go infect each system individually?
They have to get in there somehow, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. I have a bad habit of looking for USB ports when I go anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And, it doesn't.
I see so many cash registers, it would be so easy just to walk up, plug something into, and nobody would be any the wiser. And it's really dead simple to build a USB device that pretends to be a keyboard and runs commands.
And you know, looking at this, they said they got like 146,000 cards from 200 terminals.
Yep.
So like 200 terminals, that's not a lot. And they also they mentioned from Subway sandwich shops, so like wonder if that was like targeted.
That's an old one.
Oh, okay.
They're referencing an old one that was targeted. We actually talked about that one on Decking.
Oh, okay.
You say 200 major. So, say 10 of those are a major metropolitan city, Walmart.
Yep.
Now,
imagine how many credit cards go through that a day.
And it's not one point of sales terminal. They've probably got the server, so they've got all of the ones in that store.
And it doesn't even have to be a major metropolitan area. A rural store still does enough business for it to be a good idea.
Yeah. It only takes one rogue employee, man.
I guarantee you that's how they were doing it. They were getting somebody on an IRC chat or something. You know, we'll give you $500.
I'll tell you how it works, Morps. Some dude goes through higher education for 6 years for engineering in computing and can't get a job and ends up working, you know, 5-6 days a week for fuck all cash. I'm gonna put on a black hat.
Yeah, there's, I'm sure.
And turnover's high enough at most retails. He didn't sneak in. He got hired in, plugged in the USB drive himself, and left.
Went and rehired somewhere else. You know, you'd only have to hit 5 or 6 major ones to set yourself up with a decent income per week.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to go play McDonald's. I'll be back.
All right. Yep. Let's get the link here for the chat room for the next one. I've got Eustace Sard doing that for us. So copy it in. This one's also from Torrent Freak. Paste, enter. There we go. Trying to juggle tabs while I do this. And Psychros sent me a Russia Today version of the same article here. But anyways, in recent years, the U.S. government has taken an aggressive stance towards copyright infringement, both at home and abroad. Piracy is theft, clean and simple, Vice President Joe Biden said when he announced the Joint Strategic Plan to Combat Intellectual Property Theft. However, at the same time, the vice president was launching the new anti-piracy campaign. Software company Aptricity was involved in a multi-million-dollar privacy dispute with the government. In 2004, Aptricity signed a contract with the U.S. Army to license enterprise software that managed troop and supply movements. The deal allowed the government to use the software on 5 servers and 150... Good Lord! Multi-million dollars for 5 servers and 150 clients. And since then, it has been used in critical missions all over the world. The Army has used Aptricity's integrated transportation, logistics, and asset management software across the Middle East and other theaters of operation. The Army has also used the software to coordinate emergency management initiatives, including efforts following the January 2010 earthquake in Haiti, the company explains. While Aptricity was happy to have the government as a client, the company was shocked to find out that the Army had secretly installed thousands of unlicensed copies of the software. The unauthorized use was discovered by accident during strategic capabilities planning in 2009, when the U.S. Army program director stated that thousands of devices used Aptricity software. As it turned out, the Army had installed pirated copies of the software on 93 servers and more than 9,000 standalone devices, with license fees of $1.35 million per server and $5,000 per device. Good God! And I think Windows is expensive. Aptricity calculated that the government owed the company $224 million in unpaid fees. To recoup the missing revenue, the software company filed a lawsuit at the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. It accused the government of willful copyright infringement while actively concealing the infringements from Aptricity. The government knew or should have known that it was required to obtain a license for copying Aptricity software onto each of the servers and devices, the company told the court, demanding a minimum of the $224 million in damages, an amount equal to the shortfall in license revenue. The government eventually admitted that it used many copies of the software without permission, and after lengthy negotiation, both parties have now decided to settle the case. After alternative dispute resolution proceedings, the parties agreed to settle for $50 million. Damn, that's a drop. Well, you're suing the government, so...
Well, you know. Yeah, it's like, well, we'll give you $50 million, or you can just piss off.
Yeah.
But what... Remember, I think it was last year we were talking about this. Victorian police here in this country did it. Thousands of illegal copies and just went, and we're the police, so buck off.
Yep. The figure represents a fraction of the software's negotiated contract value that provides a material quantity of servers and device licensing for ongoing and future Department of Defense usage, Aptricity just announced. Despite the copyright dispute, Aptricity expects it will continue its business relationship with the U.S. military. Now that this process is behind us, it is envisioned that Aptricity and the Army relationship will continue to grow exponentially, says Tim McHale, an Aptricity senior advisor and retired major general. The Obama administration has yet to comment on the settlement, but a statement is forthcoming and will almost certainly be less vocal on privacy, the piracy front, especially since the government now finds itself on the other side of the fence. So... Yeah.
Did you just say that the advisor for Aptricity was a retired major general?
Yes, I did.
The same Aptricity that charges, what is it, $120,000 a year for a server and $5,000 a year for a computer?
Yes, I did.
Interesting. I see no connections here at all.
No conflict of interest whatsoever.
It's completely legitimate military. Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't even finish that.
Yeah. If it's so blatant to us, really, and no one's doing shit about it,
it's that no one cares or notices.
Or they're too scared to go after the military.
But it's, yeah, not, it's possible. It's not just there, man. It's every level of government now. It's like, well, who's in this year? Well, it's someone's son's turn to run as senator for so-and-so, but he'll win because he's got the last name, you know?
Well, and it's easy.
How many people actually pay attention to what their politicians do?
I do.
It's just like the damned the FCC chairman is a former lobbyist for the wrong people. The very people he's supposed to be regulating, he was lobbying for. And now he's the chairman
and
of the
no
regulatory.
No one saw that as a conflict of interest. So there's no one sitting there going, under the rules and regulations of this administration, that can't be done?
Or apparently not.
Just goes out.
So, it's just rampant corruption. Everything's fucking corrupt. So I keep looking for the pin to fall out of Bitcoin. I figure there's some corruption there.
But, yeah.
I don't think I have enough blood to make it to the end of the show. Hemorrhaging everywhere.
It's all boiled off.
Okay, let's wrap this up. We're going to end up close to on time, as opposed to an hour and a half show like we have been doing. So let's go ahead and roll into this. So I've already talked about it a little bit at the beginning of the show. I have put together a Raspberry Pi-based Bitcoin mining rig, and it's been running now for, let me just refresh the status page, 2 hours and 42 minutes, and according to BTC Guild, has netted me 0.0000521 Bitcoins. So, that's worth, like, less than a penny.
Raking in the dough, man.
It is functional, and it's actually only half the ASICs I've bought. So, I bought 4 ASIC miners to play around with, the little USB-based Bitcoin block miners. I'm more interested in playing with the technology, and I'm really interested to see if I can reprogram one of these little fuckers to use it as a SHA, 256.512 password cracker. So, yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I was playing around with John the Ripper for some stuff, and 24 hours of runtime, only got through 7 characters. So, and this was a password I already checked against all the major hash lists and rainbow tables, so it was actually a decent one. But one of these little block interrupters would be a fantastic password cracker. So, but in the meantime, I figured I might as well use them for their intended purpose. So, a couple of different ways of going about this. Adafruit, I think I've talked about it in a Digital Dojo before, has a guide on using a Raspberry Pi, a hub, some ASIC miners, and one of their LCD kits to build a little headless mining rig using Raspbian. And, you use the little LCD to monitor the progress of the system. Now, I was looking at that one for how it's pulling information for the LCD screen, because I'm going to build a case for mine and I'm probably going to put an LCD screen in it, but I don't think I'm going to use an Adafruit one, mainly because I've already got a couple of LCDs laying around and they're not the Adafruit ones. So what I found was this Raspi distro specifically for running ASIC miners called MinePeon. And MinePeon is dead simple to set up and run. I mean, it is retardedly simple. You pull down the image file, you drop it on your SD card, it boots up, you get a web interface to it, it just kind of auto-magically finds your ASICs and starts running. Now, and here's the problem. It starts running immediately before you've configured your mining pools, before you've told it who you are. It starts running for the guy who put the distro together.
Genius.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it immediately starts going and working on the mine peon donation mining pools. And he has an option in his software that you can donate so many minutes of time a day to running in his pools as a way of giving back for the development of the software, which is fine. If people, you know, want to support open source software, you know, asking for donations is a way to do it. I was a little miffed at how turned on that already was when I first got the distro. Like, it was immediately mining for him the moment I got the thing booted before I went in and configured my own settings, you know what I mean? Now, I was able to turn the donations off, and, you know, 15 minutes of time on the thing's not a big deal if you want to give back to the project. Could do without the begging at the bottom of every page once you turn donations off. It's pretty blatant.
money.
And I can understand. I mean, you know, software development's not easy, and, you know, it's kind of a time-consuming thing to put something like this together. And he's done a decent job. I mean, like I said, it's easy as hell to get a system up and running with it. And using his system, I've made, you know, less than a penny's worth of Bitcoin. But, about 3 hours worth of work, it's not doing bad, actually. So I may end up turning the donations on. Not going to do the 15 minutes, maybe more like 5 or 3. But I might turn it on just to do it. But, it's not bad. It's a quick way to get this thing up and running, and using a Raspi as opposed to a full computer with this thing. I think I did the math earlier. I think I was, you know, using all of like 3 watts as opposed to what's your average PC power supply, 300 to 500?
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, gets the power cost down of trying this. So it's, I've already got the hardware, so why not, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Yeah. That power usage is so low. I'm just thinking about when I was doing some Bitcoin mining, or, you know, just trying it out, and running off my GPU, I can't even imagine how much power that must have been pulling through. Probably like a good 500 watts at least. And that's just 3. It should be a lot more cost effective.
Well, I've got a couple of old rack mount routers out in the garage left over from something, but I don't have the interfaces that you really need to use them. They're mm-hmm. the old style serial routers, for ISDN lines and shit like that. So one of those, I was thinking I might gut it, because they've got fans in those cases. And, you know, I've got a fan pointed at the ASIC miners, but they're not getting that hot, really. I mean, they get warm, and I guess, they probably would be hot to the touch if I didn't have the fan on them. But, I mean, they're not that bad. So I was thinking you set up a case that's designed to have decent airflow, you know, maybe even use the case as a heatsink, and just kind of build it all into that, make a nice little box out of it, and just throw it in the corner and let it run. So,
as long as it's no effort, you're all good.
Yeah. And, you know, hey, if I manage to make a couple of Bitcoin, cool. If not, well, something to play with. I still like the concept of maybe trying to mine some of the other cryptocurrencies with it, just so you have a collection of them. They have to be the kind that you can actually mine. Like, I know Litecoin, you have to mine on GPUs, that there's no ASIC miners for that one, and it uses a different hash. But the ones that are Bitcoin compatible, you could mine, possibly even later convert those into Bitcoin. But I don't know. I'm still, you know, I'm wanting to play around with Bitcoin, but I'm not all in on it. You know, I don't see it as the future. I just see it as something interesting. So. Anyways, though, it's stupid easy to put this thing together. The way I ended up assembling it, you take the Raspi after you put the SD card in it, you put a powered USB hub, and that's probably the most important thing, because the Raspberry Pi does not have enough power on its USB ports to run these ASIC miners. So you put them on a powered USB hub, you turn the thing on, you go configure the software for your pool, and you're laughing, and that's it. So, you know, this mine Peon really is dead simple. It kind of turns your Raspberry into like a little Bitcoin appliance, really. But anyways, that's really all I've got for today. I'm using Multibit for my Bitcoin wallet if anybody's interested. Just, you know, something to grab, something to run. I wasn't terribly concerned about which one. I didn't want to use any of the online ones. They seem to keep getting hacked. So that is something, is if Bitcoin keeps getting more and more popular, that you know, having your machine popped could be very expensive. So if anybody has anything else to throw out, now's the time. Otherwise, I'm going to start closing out the show.
Good. I take it the dead silence. Everyone else is good, too.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Just because we haven't said it enough, Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, hopefully I can do the next show Bitcoin-free, but we'll see. The damn thing keeps coming up. It's like all that there is half the news sites.
And it's getting more, and you're seeing it more and more on the more mainstream news sites, too.
No, that's why, is mainstream starting to notice it.
And so, one day it could be an actual currency, and that could be a great story to have.
So, of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday, Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays, The Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays, and I Have Nothing on whatever day RU moves it to, but he probably won't tell me just so I can't put it on the website. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the feedback form, the Galaxy 15 sim on OS Grid, and the subreddit. And, you know, of course, we still accept Flaming Kittens with TCP/IP. You can use the TCP/IP via Carrier Pigeon protocol. I'm sure that will work with Flaming Kittens. I'm sure it's a small adaptation. So I'm thinking I'm going to hit play on this music now. Thank you.